ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
He was a respected lawyer and Jewish leader, but now his passion for Middle East peace has made him a pariah to many. Hello there, it's the Religion and Ethics Report.
From parts of it, yes, from the people who ran those organisations towards the end of my term, yes. And that was largely because I attempted to do something which I think Jews have a duty to do, which was to try and educate our community.
Andrew West here on RN and ABC Listen, and that story is soon.
Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. Find me a find, catch me a catch.
That's how Hollywood or Broadway sees the matchmaker. It's from the musical, wonderful musical, The Fiddler on the Roof. But the modern way of meeting your mate can be pretty transactional, even a bit risky. Swipe left on the app to say thanks but no thanks. Swipe right to say give me a call. Millions of Indians, though, still use a matchmaker to find the right spouse. And in the diaspora, it's becoming cool. Richard Carmarker from the Religion News Service has been looking into the trend.
You know, religion is a large part of matchmaking, I would say, because the people who are being matchmade really tend to stick in their own religious community, and even then in their own religious micro community, I would say. And I think it's very important where a matchmaker comes in and is able to find you a match in your pool. It might be a small pool, but it's very important to kind of remain within that religious group for a lot of people.
I mean, is it important to maintaining those religious distinctions? Because we know that while India is a great democracy, it is, increasingly a sectarian country. Is it important for a Hindu mother that her daughter only marry a Hindu? And I guess the same would apply to Muslims and Christians and Jains and Buddhists.
You know, I would say from my experience that that is correct. There are a lot of changes happening, of course, where interfaith marriage or, you know, even intercaste marriage is concerned. But I do think that overall, really, a Hindu mom would want her daughter to be married to another Hindu.
India has one of the biggest and most successful diaspora populations in the world. Why would a successful young Indian in the US or Canada or Australia, you know, recently graduated from university where he or she mixed with hundreds of other ambitious people, why would they feel today in the diaspora they need a matchmaker?
What I was trying to write is that matchmaking is really getting cool again. These kids are facing this issue where they're going on dating apps and these dating apps are not working for them. They're not necessarily going to find someone who's as serious as them, and you can't vet people as well as a matchmaker would. And these matchmakers come in and they already have on paper exactly what you're looking for. And that is compatibility with your family, compatibility with whatever lifestyle, whatever socioeconomic lifestyle you'd like to live, whatever educational background you have. It's pre-vetting this pool of people that while you're dating in this modern age, you really don't know, you know, who people are, even if they're Indian, even if they are Hindu. There's a lot more requirements that people want. And people, like you said, we are, a very successful diaspora. People are looking to remain within that. And they are really turning back to this matchmaking that has been in our culture for such a long time.
How does it work with the matchmaker? You know, I have to say, I first heard of the matchmaker when I was a kid, but it was listening to the musical Fiddler on the Roof. That was about the matchmaker in the Orthodox Jewish communities in the Pale of Settlement in Russia. But how does the matchmaker in India, but also in the Indian diaspora, operate?
That's exactly my first thought of matchmaker as well. But now it's become such a lucrative business, I will say. There are matrimonial websites just flooding the internet. And these websites will kind of personalize your matchmaking experience. It's like I said, it's gotten a lot cooler in the sense that these are websites that will have you fill out what's called a bio data, which is essentially like your LinkedIn profile and your just your requirements and your values and things like that. And they have a database of hundreds or thousands of other people who they will, if you pay, you know, a high price, these matchmakers will find you probably a handful of matches that you'll be meeting throughout the course of your payment for this matchmaking service.
One of the really fascinating things to come out of your piece, and we'll put a link to it at our website, is the concern, though, that could this deepen inequality? Because, I mean, you talked about, you know, the modern dating apps. I mean, you go on Tinder, I think it is, and people do list, don't they, their income. Can't you swipe to see someone of a comparable level of education in the United States, whether they've gone to the Ivy League? There's already concern that these things, you know, according to what I've read, deepen inequality. Could matchmaking do the same?
I think it can. You know, that's the danger. And I will say one difference between this is what I'm talking about is that matchmaking is largely between two families. And that's something you're not going to bring your family on Tinder, right? You know, once these families get involved, yeah, I do see that there are definitely issues that could come about. If they're really set on finding another Harvard graduate, it's kind of exclusive and not in a good way necessarily.
Yeah, well, what was the line that you used? If you're hoping to meet a 6 foot Indian Ivy League graduate who's a medical doctor, see, it's a cliche. I mean, I know it's a cliche, but is it a real phenomenon?
The phenomenon of being too picky or expecting too much is definitely true, or expecting this knight in shining armor to be found through a matchmaking convention or through a website. That's definitely an issue. But I think that, as I mentioned in the show as well, the Netflix show, people realize that they can't have it all. And that's true for arranged matches, for non-arranged matches. And so matchmakers really try to calm people's expectations a little bit as well. And so that's an issue.
Yeah, tell us about this Netflix program, because you argue that it's actually had a huge impact on the matchmaking industry in the diaspora.
When this show came out, people were, and this is Indian matchmaking on Netflix, people love reality dating, of course, and it brought to the forefront this way of life for many Indian people and Indian people in the diaspora that matchmaking is kind of normalized now, partly due to the show that just came out. And I think so many people have been, you know, interested and curious in non-Hindus or non-Indians, I'm saying, they're curious about, oh, like, I'm not finding anyone on these dating apps either. Like, I wish I could just have a matchmaker that knows everything that I want or everything that my family wants. You know, I wish that was something that was in my culture. And I think that it has really done, I mean, there's a lot of problems with the show, as I kind of hint at, but it has done a lot. And I've spoken to the matchmakers who said, you know, it has done a lot to bring this to the forefront, that it's not this misconception of forced marriages anymore. It's really this, you know, elite service that is available to us.
Yeah. To what extent, Richa, however, has the educational and professional success of the South Asian diaspora rebounded on the love lives of young people?
Are you referring to, you know, maybe societal expectations, parental expectations, things
well,
like that?
Well, too busy studying to fall in love.
That's an issue, right? When, you know, many children of South Asian parents have been kind of raised to, okay, keep your head in the books, keep your goals right, focus on your schoolwork, focus on your education. Other kids were out there, you know, dating. Other kids were out there having, you know, a good time. And then all of a sudden you become 24, 25, and they're like, oh, have you found anyone yet? And it's perpetuating this cycle of difficulty for these kids. And that's another reason why I really think that matchmaking is becoming a little bit more popular, because it's like all of these kids, I mean, not kids, I should say young adults, are in the same boat now. They didn't get the same maybe experiences that other kids did because of how hardworking they had been. And now they're trying to figure out how to date. And if their parents are also telling them that they need to get married, because that is another pressure, then it's like, okay, where do I even start?
Forgive my naivety, but Does love play a role anymore? You know, that accidental meeting, that locking of eyes across the subway carriage, or, you know, meeting someone. I'm old-fashioned. I met my wife in the workplace. Does that play a role? Does love play a role anymore?
That type of love, meeting in the workplace, meeting in the subway, I think that's everyone's dream still. I think that hasn't changed since eternity. But as I said before, at the baseline, when you have a culture that's, you know, a marriage between these two families, it's important to a lot of these people to vet out their future match. And even in arranged marriages, the idea is that you will gradually fall in love, that attraction will grow. But at the baseline, your lifestyles and socioeconomic status match, then that's enough until love comes into the picture. So, of course, everyone would love that kind of love, but it's not as realistic for a lot of us.
Great to speak with you. Richa Carmarker, she's a senior writer at the Religion News Service. She's based in New York. We've been discussing her recent piece, How Indian Matchmaking is Cool Again. Thanks for joining us on the program, Richa.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. It was great.
Matchmaker, matchmaker, look through your book and make me a perfect match.
And this is the Religion and Ethics Report, where you're hearing about the links between religion and the news that's shaping the world. The greatest tragedy of the Gaza War and the Hamas massacre that provoked it is naturally felt by the people of Israel and Palestine. But there's pain in Australia too, where divisions have destroyed decades of goodwill built up between Jews, Christians and Muslims. One of the most dedicated interfaith leaders is barrister Robin Margot. He led the New South Wales Jewish Board of Deputies, he fought apartheid in South Africa, and he still believes the only solution in Israel and Palestine is reconciliation. Now Robin Margot finds himself an apostate in the community that he once led. He joined me in the studio.
Thank you, Andrew.
So we've had iftar dinners cancelled in New South Wales and Victoria. In Victoria, the Jewish Community Council has suspended all dealings with the Islamic Council. Jewish Australians are resigning from literary and theatre boards. There have been spikes in anti-Semitic and Islamophobic incidents. Robin, you've been a pioneer of interfaith relations. You won an award from the New South Wales government for this. Is this the worst breakdown in community relations you've seen?
I think it is, and I think the violence in Gaza is the worst that I've seen as well. The last Gaza war that I was directly involved in community relations over was the Operation Cast Lead, and that was very difficult too, but this is far worse. Mm. People on both sides are really traumatized. I think in times of war, our evolutionary group instincts make us take sides. But in these times when optimism about mutual benefit is at a very big low, it's even more important to try and keep links going. Mm. I've been for about half a decade a member of a group of Australian Palestinians and Jews, Partners for Peace. We try to understand each other's narratives and present realities, and to model something different from one-sided extremist conflict on both sides. But that's been very difficult for this small group too.
But that's intact though.
It's intact, but it's gone through some very difficult times. We respect and trust each other. There are both Muslim and Christian Palestinians in the group, men and women on both sides, but it's a very, very difficult. Members of my extended family were murdered at Kfar Azar on 7 October in front of their children, and one of their children at the age 3 was taken hostage into Gaza. Fortunately, thank God, now released. But Palestinians in our group know people who've lost 30 members of their family in Gaza. And they all have individual histories of dispossession and brutal treatment. And at a time like this, it has been very difficult. Yeah. We're still in touch with each other, and I hope that we will continue to not let our hearts harden and not lose our capacity to reach out and love.
It's impossible to capture or summarise accurately each side's pain, but it seems to be in a very rudimentary way that many Australian Jews are deeply hurt that people they'd been building relationships with for many years did not denounce sufficiently the sheer viciousness of the Hamas attack on October 7. Palestinians and their supporters argue, look, pro-Israel supporters are sanctioning the mass deaths of innocent men, women and children in Gaza under the guise of rooting out Hamas. I know that's a simplification, but are these positions irreconcilable in your view?
There are extremists on both sides. Some right-wing Israelis, their supporters in Australia, regard the horrors of October the 7th as just more evidence that Palestinians are filled with hatred, not only for Israelis, but for Jews generally. And there are messianic ethno-nationalists among them, including some members of Netanyahu's government, who oppose the creation of any Palestinian state, seek to have Israel's territory extend from the Jordan River to the sea. And on the other hand, there are some extremists on the Palestinian side, among not only Palestinians, but among some of their supporters in Australia. They deny that any real atrocities occurred on 7 October. They reject Zionism in any of its many forms. Some of them use From the River to the Sea and settler colonial tropes to deny any legitimacy whatever for the State of Israel or for Israeli Jews.
I can see how you haven't made yourself popular because you are seeking to recognise the Palestinian narrative at the same time as you are mourning, in your case, extended members of your family suffering. Does it surprise you that you haven't made yourself popular, Robin? I mean, because we're talking about someone who was at the very apex of Jewish community leadership in this country.
I'm not alone. There are many Australian Jews who think like me, and in fact many who realised the position of the Palestinians and the way their voices were silenced ahead of me. I think that's one mistake that Palestinian and their supporters sometimes make, is to treat all forms of Zionism as represented by the current Netanyahu government. I'm still a Zionist. I call myself a conditional Zionist in the sense that despite the Nakba and the violence on both sides that attended the creation of the State of Israel, I'm very familiar with generations of history of oppression of Jews. I'm grateful that in an age of nationalism they had a national voice, but I wish the same for Palestinians. And there are many, many Jews, and I speak from knowing many, both in Israel and in Australia, who share that view, who want the same for the Palestinians as they do for the Jews. But some of the mainstream organisations have crushed dissent for a long time and claim to speak for the whole community.
It raises this question with me, Robin. Are you now an apostate? Because you were the president of the New South Wales Jewish Board of Deputies. You were the vice president of the Executive Council of Australian Jewry. These were very respected positions. For decades, you've been a highly respected lawyer and mediator. Have you become an apostate in parts of the Jewish community?
From parts of it, yes. From the people who run those, who ran those organisations towards the end of my term, yes. And that was largely because I attempted to do something which I think Jews have a duty to do, which was to try and educate our community about things that I had learned the hard way about treatment of Palestinians, about what was happening in the West Bank, particularly in East Jerusalem, about settler violence. This was 2010, 2011. And I did this internally to try and correct what I thought were very extreme biases in advocacy training at the time. But it was eventually crushed by militant elements, WhatsApp groups and things like that.
Is it true, Robin, that you are the only former president of the Jewish Board of Deputies not to be made a life member?
Yes, that hurt very much. The reason given by the one particular person who blocked it was that I'd served only 2 years, which is true because the normal term has been 4 years. But I don't believe that. I'd also spent 2 years before that running the litigation that eventually silenced the Holocaust denier Frederick Tobin. So it was a 4-year stint, and I'd done a decade of other interfaith and work with the board. So I think the main reason I was not being given honorary status was that they would entitle me to continue speaking on the executive.
Yeah, it's Andrew West here with the Religion and Ethics Report. We're speaking with Robin Margot, a former president of the New South Wales Jewish Board of Deputies, now not quite so popular in certain quarters for his efforts at reconciliation. I want to talk a little bit about your background because it gives you a very sensitive perspective. You grew up in South Africa as a student. You were very active in the anti-apartheid movement. I know that you weren't literally forced out of South Africa or into exile at the sort of point of a gun or a bayonet, but I gather it was made pretty clear to you, Robin, in South Africa that you didn't have much of a future there. And if it was a future, it was one of constant harassment.
I became fearful. Friends of mine were braver and stayed. But I'd lost 4 people whom I knew closely and personally. Someone we know were murdered. One at least disappeared, and even the Truth and Reconciliation Commission never found out. I'd been beaten up by the security police. That was when Robert Kennedy came to South Africa. Some of my friends, the Afrikaans term is land verlater, which is a betrayer for leaving. I confess I couldn't stand the insecurity and the fear.
The other thing that gives you a special insight here is, can you explain to us part of the reason why South Africa took this case to the International Court of Justice against Israel? Because on the face of it, they say it's what they consider to be Israel's overreaction to October 7. But is there another grievance behind that?
Israel had close ties with the apartheid government. Israel had a realpolitik attitude to any government that was prepared to work with it or transact with it. But I would point out also that all 5 white defendants in the 12 defendant Rivonia trial were Jews. Mm. Mandela was one of those defendants as well.
Yeah.
And Jews have played a completely disproportionate role in the fight against apartheid and in the framing of the current constitution.
What was your reaction, Robin, to the news of October 7?
Well, I was terribly concerned about family members, and it sort of came out piecemeal. People talk about the sexual violence and whether it's all documented or provable, and they talk about questions raised about it, but I'd certainly...
Although the United Nations has confirmed that much of that sexual violence did occur.
Well, they've said it's plausible that it occurred. The fact is that to kill parents in front of their children, children in front of their parents, to take elderly people, toddlers, babies as hostage, to kill people who are dancing at a peace festival is atrocious. And we would condemn that if, and we do, if Palestinian resistance does it, and we would condemn it if the Jews did it. I mean, Jews have burnt villages in the West Bank, bombed the Ben Gurion Hotel in the fight for independence. No matter how just the cause, it never justifies that sort of treatment of civilians.
So by the same token, what did you then fear about Israel's retaliation?
In the early weeks, I simply couldn't second guess. I'm not an Israeli, but I couldn't second guess the military strategy. What concerned me greatly from very early on, however, was the apparent lack of any political program. Mm-hmm. I expected that there would be civilian casualties because Hamas is embedded in a very densely populated area, and Khaled Mashal has said since 7 October that...
This is one of the Hamas leaders.
Yes, he's on the member of the Politburo, and Hamas Politburo, and he said in an interview with an Arab journalist that you have to sacrifice lives for independence, and the Russians lost 30 million people to defeat the Germans. Mm-hmm. And other Hamas spokesmen said that October 7 will be repeated again and again.
Where do we go from now in Australia, a country that, despite all the naysayers, I would still argue, along with Canada, is probably the most successful post-war multicultural country in the world? Where do we go to now?
I think it's essential in the Israel-Palestinian conflict and in the relations between Jews, Muslims and Palestinian supporters in Australia that we stand up to extremism on both sides. I think it's quite possible to condemn the atrocities of October the 7th, and some Palestinians and their supporters have done that, and still to promote the Palestinian cause and to talk about the bad treatment that Palestinians have received for decades. Palestinians need to recognize that not all Jews are the same, that there's a wide range of opinions, and that if there's to be any progress towards Palestinian self-determination, they need allies. I am really inspired, and it's kept me going through this very dark period, by something that Rashid Khalidi said.
Rashid Khalidi, he's a Columbia University professor, a Palestinian intellectual.
Yes, his family has a long history of Samud and resistance. And in one of his most recent books, 100 Years' War on Palestine, which is a pure settler colonial analysis, something that I think is a misapplication. But I read the book because I respect him. And towards the end, I came across the statement by him, which gave me tremendous comfort. There are now two peoples in Palestine, irrespective of how they came into being, and the conflict between them cannot be resolved as long as the national existence of each is denied by the other. And I find it particularly inspiring that a person with his history and with his view of the origins of the Israeli state and of the behavior of Zionism, which I don't share in all respects at all, could say that. And I think it's true. So I think that the duty of Israelis and Palestinians, and certainly of their supporters in Australia, is to educate our respective communities about the realities that the other side lives under, and to work towards a long-term mutual benefit. I think it's extremely important to keep that hope and flame alive.
Well, there aren't too many people doing it at the moment, but you are. Rob and Margot, thank you so much for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you, Andrew.
And Robin is very much a former president of the New South Wales Jewish Board of Deputies and vice president of the Executive Council of Australian Jewry. And that is it for this episode. In the next couple of weeks, we'll be looking at a new phenomenon on the religious right in the United States, the raunchy evangelical. Apparently sex sells, even from the pulpit. This is definitely not your grandma's moral majority. And going back to our earlier reference to Broadway, we'll look at the golden age of Judaism in the United States. We've got a fascinating interview with Franklin Foer of The Atlantic magazine. You can follow us at the ABC Listen app. If you do find us in other places, maybe you'll give us a review, because it does help others find us. A big thanks to Hong Jiang and Roy Huberman. I'm Andrew West. Join us again for the Religion and Ethics Report.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.